This podcast is brought to you by the Gosh Learning Academy.
Welcome to the fourth series of Gosh Pods Goes Green. In this series, we're going to be focusing on plastics in healthcare. Notably, single-use plastics represent approximately 23% of the NHS's total waste. These materials are seldom recycled and are predominantly incinerated at high temperatures, contributing significantly to the NHS's overall carbon footprint. And in 2021, Great Ormond Street Hospital was the first UK children's hospital to declare a climate and health emergency. Over the next 6 weeks, we are going to be exploring this topic further, moving on from well-known facts about plastics being made from fossil fuels and taking hundreds of years to decompose, to talking about the health implications of plastics and what healthcare professionals can do at a product and systems level to reduce plastics. How do we balance the risk with infection control? And finally, what happens to plastics in waste? Today is our final episode of this series, and I'm joined by Rhiannon Putman, our waste manager at Great Ormond Street, and Liam Hogg, head of waste and resources at NHS England, who is leading the opportunities to reduce waste in the sector from data to infrastructure and sustainability. Hello and welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Hi, Nicola.
Good afternoon.
I guess the easiest place or the most natural place to start is by saying, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves and your goals within the NHS, your goals and roles, I should say. Rhiannon, can I start with you?
Yeah. So I first joined working in and around the NHS in 2020, so just after the COVID period. I first worked for a company called Suston Limited, who would go around multiple NHS trusts and audit their compliance with waste segregation according to the HTM 0701. 18 months ago, I got the opportunity to join Great Ormond Street as their interim waste manager. That opportunity was presented to me because I'd also done the CIWM Waste Managers course during my tenure at Suston. So for the last 18 months, I've been the waste manager at Great Ormond Street. What I would say my ultimate goals in my role and within sort of the NHS are to help the trust achieve 60-20-20 with their clinical waste, to become more sustainable both economically and environmentally, and to become more compliant. So we're not doing badly, but there's definitely areas for improvement at Great Ormond Street.
I think I'm going to highlight one of those areas for improvement straight away. Can you explain to me, what do you mean by 60-20-20?
So NHS England a few years ago announced that the target for the NHS nationally and for trusts is to reach 60% offensive waste, 20% HTI waste, and 20% AT, which is alternative treatment waste. So it's the segregation goal of clinical waste and how much we should have of each category.
I love this. This is a beautiful example of where someone clinical like me speaks a whole different language. And, you know, that kind of highlights straight away, gosh, there must be barriers just in language in this complexity. Rhiannon, thank you so much. How about you, Liam?
So I've been in and around the NHS a little bit longer than Rhiannon. I actually have a background in engineering. I used to be a civil engineer. Got headhunted into a clinical waste management company and was responsible for, did 10 years there for running various regions, ending up running the south of England region for White Rose Environmental, who became Stericycle. Just before I finished working for those guys, I was commissioning the first autoclave that they had for alternative treatment. And it was at that time I realised that the NHS had a bit of a problem in terms of waste segregation. And I decided to try and do something about that. set up a company to work on educating the NHS into how they should be segregating their waste. And that journey has taken me to many places. I spent 10 years at Barts, and I was the waste manager at Barts for 10 years, where I got to know my current boss, Fiona Daly. And I actually got seconded from that position to work in what they call the National Logistics Cell. Firstly, in 2017, there was a clinical waste company that collapsed, and the NHS lost a third of its clinical waste collections overnight. And I was brought in to run the logistics cell, which was to ensure that hospitals didn't stop because they were overflowing with waste. That was about 2 years worth of work. And during those 2 years, it was extremely stressful. We learned a massive amount about all the areas that we didn't know about. And at the end of that, we wrote a playbook to, so if there was another incident like that, you know, how we would manage it better. We presented that to the Cabinet Office, and I thought that was my once in a lifetime catastrophe done. And within 6 months, we were into COVID. And so I then spent the next 2.5 years back in the logistics cell, dealing with the overflowing amount of waste that we had during COVID. At the end of that, I was asked to come forward for an interview for a national role within NHS England, which is quite amusing because for 30 years I've been railing against the idiots that wrote the rules. And then I got asked, would you like to come in and write the rules? So I am now the idiot that wrote the last amount of rules. So the latest version of HTML 701, which came out in 2023, that was my responsibility to have that published. I worked with a number of people on that. It's all in, you can see the list of people in the HTM. And the other thing that we did was to strengthen the HTM and to try and do something different than what happened in previous iterations of that, was to draw up a clinical waste strategy, which actually became much more detailed in terms of who was to do what and when, and whose responsibility it was and when. And the idea being is that we could actually move the whole of the issue regarding waste segregation, improved compliance, into a process where we're reducing carbon in line with the goals that the NHS had set themselves to be net zero by 2040. And so and I joined NHS England 4 and a bit years ago. So now my role is to take those rules that some idiot has written, and now I get to deliver them. So my responsibility is to work with all the trusts up and down the country so they clearly understand what's in those regulations and how best we can deliver them.
Wow, that is quite a journey. But what you filled me with is a little bit of hope, because you're telling me that as the lead in this field, you've already been through two really large adaptation issues. And that for me, I think is hopeful for the future, because we know we're going to see with this climate crisis a number of events happening that we don't necessarily see coming down the line. And we're going to need leaders that know how to adapt in that field. So what a relief. That is good to know you're at the top. I suppose the next question I was going to ask you both is a bit of a personal one, and it's one that I've been asking people across the series, because it strikes me that people have either a background feeling and a gut instinct about where we should be with the environment, or sometimes a trigger point, a moment where they go, oh, wow, this is happening. I'm seeing the change within the world around me, within nature, within, you know, the volumes of plastics, whatever it may be. And it gives them that sense of urgency. And then we end up with people like you, people that go, I'm going to work in this field. I'm going to do my bit that I can within my profession to make a difference. Either of you, or both of you, have you had trigger points? Is that something you can relate to? You're both nodding. Liam, what would you say?
I think this started when I was very, very young. I joined the Cubs the year before I was before you're supposed to. I literally wouldn't leave them alone until they let me come in. And from joining the Cubs, I was always taught not to leave a mark. So leave no mark of where you've been. And that means, you know, don't leave rubbish anywhere. If you've camped somewhere, when you leave, it shouldn't look like anyone's been there. And I suppose that sort of stuck with me all through my life, you know. So that was pretty ingrained with me from the age of about six onwards. And I suppose the next major trigger point for me was, as I mentioned earlier, I was the last job I did before I left White Rose was to commission a clinical waste autoclave. And to do that, we needed to get hospitals to volunteer to send me waste that we could put in the machine and test that the machine was working properly. And that was the first time we'd seen clinical waste since, because up till that point, all the waste that we had got tipped into incinerator, and the next time we saw it was ash. Well, with this process, we actually tipped the waste into carts. The carts got wheeled into this big steel tube. They were stayed in there for 40 minutes at 140 degrees, 1.5 bar. And when it came out, basically, it treated the waste so that it was now inert waste. But bags had all opened up. So now we could actually see what was inside all the clinical waste bags. And I was shocked to find that they were full of chocolate boxes, daffodils, Coke cans, and pretty much no clinical waste whatsoever. And I thought it was such a problem that we actually increased the number of hospitals that we were taking their waste to put it through the process, and everyone's waste we put it through was exactly the same. And it was at that point that I realised something needed to be done about that. That added to the thing, I'm one of these people that believes that sustainability is not something that's new. Sustainability is actually very old. You know, when my granddad was young, if he had a hole in his sock, they didn't throw the sock away. It was darned and he carried on wearing it. So actually, all we're doing is to unlearn a way of life that we've got where we dispose of things and to start looking at how we can increase the value of the resources that we use and circularize those resources. And so that's brought me quite a long way and sort of aligned me with the NHS goals. And also it aligns you with what's going on in the climate because, you know, we're constantly using natural resources. And if you look at the natural resources that we're using, it exceeds what the planet can turn out every year. And so that's not sustainable. And that I think we've, as a society, we've become lazy. And I think it's relatively straightforward and easy for us to use the technologies that are being developed around us to end up with a very different future, which doesn't harm the environment going forwards. And, you know, I've got two little grandsons that are 6 and 4. And, you know, you want the world to be for them as it was for me when I was younger. So that's another driver for me, to be honest.
That is so brilliant. I feel like I could talk for ages just even on those points. The fact that our overshoot day for the UK is something like the 17th of May, so the point at which we are no longer sustainable with the way that we take from the earth and the resources, it's scary. Like, that is just phenomenally scary. And, you know, I think many people that listen to this will hear that experience of, you know, your grandfather's socks being mended and stuff like that. I would almost take that back to, I don't know if you've ever read Braiding Sweetgrass about indigenous communities, but there's this beautiful word called reciprocity, and that idea of only taking just what you need from the earth, but allowing it its own ability to sustain itself. And that's the way we really should be thinking. We are massive overconsumers, aren't we? Yeah.
And you know, the Aborigines have been doing this for about 10,000 years. So yeah. It's not new.
Yeah, we have a lot to learn from people, 100%. Rhiannon, that's quite a hard one to follow. What would you say?
So mine is slightly different. But in a similar way in that I grew up in and around clinical waste. For as long as I can remember, my family have worked in and around clinical waste. So it's always been drilled into me. I've always was always the dinner table conversation. for a long time it bored me so much when I was younger, but at the same time it was going in. So there's that, that's sort of where it started from. I would say the one trigger point that I can really pinpoint, and it, I can remember it as clear as day, is like I said earlier, I joined the NHS just after COVID. So we there were still heavy COVID restrictions in all the hospitals. So I'd say the main we was out the main pandemic. Most people had gone back to work, but especially in the hospitals, they were still, it took the hospitals a long time to get over any restrictions. And one of the tasks, so the company that I used to work with, yes, they were to do with segregation, and but what they were really, or they still are, is about sustainability. So a task that they got given and got assigned to me was to go to, there was one of the Nightingale centres, if you remember them, was in the Excel in London. And so once it got disbanded, because it was never actually used, it was set up and then it was disbanded, and they moved all of the materials that they had bought for this Nightingale, they moved it into this giant warehouse, not far from the Excel in London. Myself and one of my colleagues have got tasked to go there because there were some products that we could arrange to be sent to Sri Lanka so that they could be used. Very, very few. I mean, a drop in the ocean to what was there. But I remember walking into this building, and it was, I cannot describe how large this building was. And as you, it was just a warehouse. So as you walked in, it was like when you go to Costco and there's all the stacks and stacks and stacks going up, stories of just products. And they had everything that you would need in a hospital, absolutely everything. And one of the questions I remember asking is, oh, what's that over there? And it was sanitizer, hand sanitizer. And but it had gone off. And I said, so what's going to happen with that? And they said, oh, it needs to be disposed of. There must have been hundreds upon thousands, hundreds of thousands, sorry, of containers of this hand sanitizer. It was just so much waste, and it stuck with me ever since. But working in around the NHS, I see that waste, not to the same extent, but I see it all day, every day. And not just in the actual waste, but in the way that I think the NHS works. It's not sustainable at all. In every department, I think there is just so much waste. So that was sort of, I'd say that was my real trigger point to say, actually, this is a major issue and it does need to be dealt with.
We have so much to learn, don't we? From these incidents, these occasions when pandemics happen, and they will happen with an increased frequency, and we need to be ready for that. But also to learn about the inequity of health systems across the world. And actually, we shouldn't be sitting on our laurels in this privileged position that we are in, worsening the effects for other communities. That's quite a image that you conjure there of a trigger point. And yeah, that will stay with me for a while now. I'm going to bring it back a little bit to in-house in the hospital. And if you were a lay person and you had not lived having the conversation of waste at the dinner table, but this was a new conversation to you, a lot of people might well think, why is there not just like a normal waste, a clinical waste and recycling in the hospital? Are there more complexities to that? What does that look like? What are the different things that you see and the complications, Rhiannon?
So, I mean, even in those three waste streams, there's multiple waste streams within them. So, for example, in normal waste, you have bulky waste, you have household waste, but then you look at clinical waste. Clinical waste goes anything from offensive waste, which is the lowest grade of clinical waste, then you've got infectious waste, you've got sharps waste, pharmaceutical waste, cytotoxic waste. So, just clinical waste outlines a number of waste categories at different levels of the hierarchy. And we always, refer to waste as a hierarchy because it is. And that's the very reason that you need so many different types of waste, because to dispose of it safely, all of these different waste categories need to be treated at a in different ways and at a different level. So the way that offensive waste, which is just, to, like you said, to a layperson, is just the general day-to-day clinical waste. So it's anything that's been contaminated with a bodily fluid, it's the PPE, it's your sort of everyday waste from a non-infectious person. The way that is treated is entirely different to how you would need to safely treat a cytotoxic needle. So cytotoxic is usually a chemotherapy drug. So those two are so far on the different ends of the spectrum. And really and truly, offensive waste is not clinical waste, but I think in this example, it's been referred to as, but that, yeah, they would be treated so differently to be treated safely. And if you was to try to put them into one category, then it would be incredibly unsafe. So that's really why.
I think that gives a really good understanding. You know, when I went into nursing, you learn about patient observations, you learn how to recognize deterioration, you learn so many things. But waste isn't necessarily something that as clinicians we learn about, and so we don't necessarily talk that language. And there are so many different professions within the NHS that need to understand the complexities that you're describing, because actually we all have that responsibility, don't we? Because at the end of the day, somebody that doesn't know what you've put in the bag will be handling it.
Yes.
And that's a real danger. And you don't want to make them your future patient, do you? That's like your avoid at all costs. Yeah.
That really is a key issue, that it's people not who aren't clinicians, aren't necessarily clinically trained, and who have no idea where that waste has come from or who it's come from, that will be treating it. So that's one of the key reasons why it needs to be correctly segregated, so that they can look at the bag or the sharps unit or the pharmaceutical unit and have some kind of understanding of what is in there, when really they're blind to what is in there.
Yeah, completely. Liam, from a national perspective, how significant is our contribution when it comes to waste? And I guess I would ask, particularly being this series talking about plastics, what's that look like, and does it vary across regions?
So just to add to what Rhiannon said there, the complexity of waste from healthcare, like everything else in healthcare, waste is highly regulated. I would estimate at Great Ormond Street and most other hospitals in the similar vein acutes, there'd be up to 40 or more individual waste streams that all have to be carefully segregated and then treated in very different ways. So that's the task that waste managers have got in the NHS. We produced 156,000 tonnes of clinical waste a year, and about 180,000 tonnes of, I would call it domestic waste, let's just call it that. And included in the domestic waste would be all the recycling or recycled elements that we would be able to pull out of those waste streams. We don't actually keep a record of the amount of plastics either that we buy or that ends up in those waste streams. But we're all aware of where the plastics are. Pretty much everything that comes to an NHS hospital is wrapped in plastic. And you might find there's various layers of that wrapped in plastic. And then the product inside may also be plastic. And actually, plastic's a really interesting thing at the moment, because generally speaking, we would regard from a sustainability perspective that plastics are bad. That they use fossil fuels to create plastics, and those plastics, when they've been used and they're disposed of, we've all seen the pictures of plastics in the seas. I think for 15 years I was trying to bring people's attention to this, and whatever the words were, I couldn't really crank that handle. And then one day the Blue Planet showed plastics floating in the sea, And my life became 1,000 times easier after that because people got it. Interestingly enough, most of the plastics that's flowing into the sea is in seven rivers. They come from seven rivers, and they're either in China, India, or Russia. They're all in that sort of zone of the world. And so one of the things that we can do as the NHS is to ensure that we don't export any of our plastic rubbish. And so we actually contain that. And I think, you know, really and truly, that's one of the things that's really changed in the last few years is that we've contained that now. And actually, there's some really exciting things going on in terms of plastics. One of the really cool areas I get to be involved in is working with academia and looking at so my title is split into two, waste and resources. So waste is about segregation and resources about taking whatever's in that segregated waste and see if we can use it again. So there's plenty of universities up and down the company, up and down the country. And if you speak to the Design for Life team, this is the sort of thing that they're looking at as well, where we're actually taking materials and there are companies that are taking clinical waste, treating it. That treatment ends up with a flock, and within that flock, there's plastics. They then can take that plastic, they can then float the plastics out of that flock. So they segregate the plastics out. They put a special treatment on the plastics, and then they're actually able to create plastic granules. And those plastic granules are then being used to create plastic clinical waste bins from plastic from clinical waste. So actually, we've starting to develop the loop, even in terms of the plastics. And I suspect that what we'll find is that we can do that with some of the plastics, but not all. And then the trick will be to eliminate those plastics out through procurement. So we can actually say, these are the materials that we want, and because we can do things to them that they can be reused afterwards. And these are the materials that we want to stop coming in the first place. It's a bit of a weird story. So whilst it's, you know, plastics in the environment, I agree with you, is not a great thing. We are doing some absolutely fantastic work in the NHS in this field. And actually, I went to Holland and was part of a group that were presenting about clinical waste. And 15 years ago, when I was working in the NHS, I was looking up to Holland in terms of the quality of what they're doing. We have surpassed where they are in 15 years. We've actually managed to get past that. We've still got plenty of work to do, but I actually think there's a real, people can begin to believe now, you know, when I have a plastic clinical waste bin in my hand, which has been made from plastic from clinical waste, people go, wow, I get it. And so there's a real hope for us there to take as much of those plastics out of the environment.
That is really good to hear, because you hear this when you're in sustainability, almost everybody's first response to you is, oh, well, I try to recycle. And you think, gosh, there's so much depth to this waste conversation beyond what recycling. But it's good to hear that it's going well and we're at least pointing in the right direction. That's really positive. And also your reflection on making sure that the plastics stay and our waste stay within our shores, and that we're not just dumping them on someone else's doorstep is a relief. My sister works in the illegal shipment of waste, and so for me, just like you guys, that is a common day conversation around the table, probably less disgusting than the conversations we'd have if we were both nurses. But yeah, she certainly educates me on things, and I hear a little bit of overlap there of what you're saying about plastics and plastic types. You know, sometimes I would go to put something in the recycling and she would be telling me off immediately, because there's some plastics that you can and can't. And we see it with things like blister packs, don't we, with your medications and stuff. It's so complex because the base that you've got the pill out of will be one type of plastic, and then there's an adhesive, and then there's foil. And these are really complex designed products.
And you know, that blister pack thing is a really interesting subject as well, because with pharmaceuticals in waste, there's no lower limit to the amount of pharmaceutical content. So if you think of things like paracetamol, paracetamol is actually quite chalky. Yep. So if it's in a bottle or it's in a blister pack, it will leave a chalky residue. That bottle and that blister pack, if it's got any pharmaceutical content whatsoever, has to be incinerated at least 850 degrees. So I was at a conference recently, which was up at Loughborough University, and we had GlaxoSmithKline Beecham, a representative from them. And I know the guy quite well, so I was quite gobby to him. And I said to him, why can't you just coat all your tablets so that they don't leave any chalky residues? And he said, basically, because the NHS won't pay for it. Because if they did that, all the packaging associated with all of the tablets and everything else actually wouldn't need to be burnt. We could actually recycle them. And what happens is we get in a room and we start discussing these things, and then little lights start going on, and then people go away, and then these things develop into something. So in the future, we will end up, I'm sure, with the blister packs, we won't have to burn them. And actually, then we can say we want the packs made out of these materials and not those materials, because we can do something with this. And if it's all joined together like this, then we can't. So we just need to look at it. And this is the cool thing about the design for life thing. The key is in the word design. So we design with the end in mind and not the just the use.
Yeah. And when I'm looking at reducing plastics within healthcare and the different projects that I do, it's really fascinating talking to manufacturers, and they want your engagement. They want to know and understand how you're clinically going to use their product, because they're not clinicians, but they also don't necessarily have infection control teams in their organizations and things like that. So we can work so well in that collaboration to help change the designs that we want. Yeah, that's a brilliant theme that I've seen kind of come through time and time again. That I think is inspiring. It is really good. If we don't ship our waste abroad, but we are trying to recycle where we can, are there any outstanding countries? You've already said that we're doing pretty well, but are there any examples and things that you see out there that you think we could take lead from?
I actually Googled this morning because I'm pretty much focused within the UK. Really interesting, the conversation I had in Holland a few months back, because I would definitely have looked up to the guys in Holland. Their clinical waste segregation was off the scale 15 years ago. We've surpassed that. And what we're doing with the materials post-use has actually surpassed that as well. The best performing countries are Germany, Austria, and Switzerland in Europe. It's not hard to imagine that. And one of the things I would say is that they've done better on the continent than we do here is they have national colours for everything. So whether you're in an airport, a hospital, a train station, at home, anywhere, it's the same colour coding for each material that you're going to put into that bin. I remember when I first went to Barts, and I was all excited about being the waste manager there. And I was going home one night, and I was walking through, there's an estate at the back of Royal London Hospital. And as I walked through the estate, just at the corner of my eye, I caught orange bags on top of domestic waste bins in the estate. And my heart, it just sank. I thought, that's the end of that career then. And then when I went over and had a look, what I found was Tower Hamlets recycling colour was orange, next to a hospital that has alternative technology clinical waste as orange. And I suppose it sounds really, really, really simple, but when you're trying to get a message out to millions of people, you need a consistent message. Well, whether it's millions of people or thousands of people like in the NHS, we need a simple, consistent message that we just repeat over and over and over and over. And in the end, it becomes in our psyche and becomes second nature. But I think that's one of the things that helps them more, is the fact that on a national basis, they have a national colour coding for their waste streams.
I love that. We have it in the clinical realms. Anything airway is always green. Anything enteral-wise, those things that are going in your stomach, is always purple. So we do that already. And that can only help us, can't it? It can only help because it'll help us build that muscle memory for what goes where. That would be a lovely development. Do you think you'll see that one through, or is that?
Do you know what? I think the signs are yes. Interesting enough, when we launched the clinical strategy in the HTM back in 2023, I remember walking up to the lectern and I was so excited. It took us a year to get the documents together. So excited. Before I got to the lectern, somebody pulled my elbow, and it was my counterpart in the Environment Agency. And he whispered into my ear, he said, "Liam, you've got to stop burning waste." And I was like, yeah. And he said, "No, listen, you've got to stop burning waste." I said, "Okay." And actually, that's what's happening now. We are stopping burning waste. We are treating more. And so because we're stopping burning waste, what we need to do is we need to understand what's in the waste streams in a lot more detail, which means we start to focus on it. You know, part of the strategy was that every NHS trust had access to a waste manager, and that waste manager has been properly trained. So it actually becomes a profession, because it's not easy to do this. And as we walk through this, because in the past, things have been set down and we just follow what's happening in the past. We're on the leading edge of things now. So we're actually starting to look at the development of the future. So that future is not set by any stretch of the imagination. And so the more work we do on this, the more we understand, the more we'll get to it.
Yeah. It's fascinating you saying about burning and things like that. I think recently Rhiannon and I had this conversation, particularly about pharmaceuticals. And yes, we have to highly incinerate certain things. And there's that always that balance, isn't there, between the carbon output of that. But for me as a clinician, I actually more worry about the ecotoxicity of things that we might be putting into our environment. So it's a really hard balance between your planetary boundaries there to think, when they're all pulling me, which one is the most essential and what do we have to do? And I hope that as clinicians, we will be able to understand a bit more of those complexities and how, if we get things wrong, it will affect our patient groups. And it will affect all of our health with that kind of toxicity and things. Yeah. This is a fascinating conversation. Rhiannon, I like to think that we should showcase projects from other hospitals. And I've heard about a great scheme at Hertfordshire where they use an on-site baler, and it's enabled them to resell some of their plastics when they've segregated them properly. Is that something that we could do? Like,
I mean, I believe it could be. We are actually, not to take us off topic, but I actually have a project in motion at the moment to get us a cardboard baler on site, because at the moment all of our cardboard goes into just the recycling compactor with everything else. And then when you actually delve into that, the actual reuse of that cardboard is quite minimal, because it gets wet, it gets crushed, it causes me all sorts of problems with the actual baler, because the baler doesn't like the cardboard. Once it sort of squashes it down, it comes straight back out. So I am actively working on a project to get this baler in. It's all been authorised. The issue we have at GOSH is the same issue we have with anything you do at GOSH. It's the space. Yeah. So a space has been agreed. It just has to be approved, because it's actually in the ZCR building, which we have shared occupancy of. But the reason I'm pointing it out is because I'm all for these projects. I would love to have a plastic one as well. And again, it's the exact same with the cardboard one, because of how it would be correctly segregated, because it would be baled, because it would be kept far more intact, we can then sell it on. So not only are we not paying to dispose of it, you can actually make some money off of it. But to be honest, that's not really, I'm not too concerned about that. I just want to get it out of the baler. But yeah, if the biggest thing that would stand in our way is space, not just on where the baler would go and where we'd keep the bowels, but you would then need another category to segregate. Where would you keep the plastics? And this is the same conversations I've had with the cardboard. you would have to create a new space in every department of where they would, where it would go in the bin by a bed space, where that would then be transported to a waste hold, how that would be taken to the baler. So these are all things that I would never say no to, but they're considerations to have. And that's why that it does take a long, long time for these to go through.
Yeah,
and the worst thing you can do is put it in place and it to not go right.
Yeah, 100%. And I think add to that complexity. So those things that you're saying about space, about segregation, exactly what Liam's told us earlier is that what happens if the system breaks down outside of your control? What happens if suddenly someone can't collect that bale and you end up accruing that waste? Yeah, complex and well, hard to work through.
I would add to what Rhiannon's trying to do there, because 2012 probably, we put cardboard balers into Barts, and we did it as part of an overall process because we were doing the same. We were putting our cardboard into the compactors. Our average compactor weight at that time was probably about 3.5 tons per compactor. By taking the cardboard out so it doesn't spring inside the compactor, we went from 3.5 tons to 7 tons. That single process, not only did we get money for the baled cardboard that we had, but what it also did was it reduced our transport by 50%. That reduced the carbon for the transport by 50%. We did it over 2 years, and we actually got a carbon trust mark for the trust just through doing exactly what Rhiannon's trying to do there. And so, you know, some of these things can have a knock-on effect. So, you know, I know the yard at Great Elmwood Street, and it's like a telephone box. And if you can reduce the traffic in that yard by half, that's massive. And so there are things like that you can do. And Rhiannon's quite right. You know, there's limited space in a lot of hospital sites. You know, Royal London, and, you know, if I think of Bart's waste yard, it's probably even smaller than Great Ormond Street, which means you just have to be clever about what you can do and be successful in it. And, you know, by baling cardboard and half-ton bales, that's exactly how the paper mills want to receive that waste, and that's why they're prepared to pay you to have that back. And so it can be done with the same with aluminium cans. You know, average price for aluminium cans about £900 a ton, and plastics is probably nearer about £300 a ton. But you do need space to be able to do this, and so it's not always an option. And there are other ways of doing things which we can come on to maybe a bit later in the discussion.
Yeah, well, I suppose let's come on to it now. Have you seen other things happening in other NHS trusts that you think we should showcase, that we should follow their examples?
Well, I think you're selling yourselves a bit short, because, you know, if you think of my, I think of one of my favourite campaigns that's, we're trying to turn it into a national campaign, is the Gloves Off campaign that you guys did. It really opened the eyes to everybody of what could be done. And, you know, Rhiannon was talking about hierarchy earlier on, and the highest form of waste management is not having it in the first place. So if you can eliminate usages that you don't need. So there's a number of things going on at the moment where people are looking at single-use items. So I would include in that gloves. I would also include in that couch roll, where it's been used, where it needs to be used, and stuff like that. That's going up there. And the thing is, you know, when we sit on the Design for Life group, I think they've got a priority list of about 20 items that they're looking at. You know as well as I do, in the hospital, there's hundreds of thousands of items. And I think what we need to do is to develop a culture that says, this is single use. What am I doing? Is there an alternative to this? You know, some of the things that's happened in the past where we've gone from reusable items to single use has resulted in things like, for instance, linen, laundry and sterile services departments closing because we don't need them anymore. And now to go back, we might need to open those. So there's a lot of work being done at the moment looking at linen, laundry and sterile services on in situ, going back almost to the good old days. And then maybe looking at, you know, new alternatives to reusable items, because that will stop it going in the waste in the first place. And I think, you know, as I say, what's you know, when I talk to other trusts, one of the things we talk about Great Ormond Street is the Gloves Off campaign that you run, because I think it's a fabulous thing. Another one, if you're not doing it, is things like walking aids. So if you've got walking aid reuse schemes, I mean, similar to what Rhiannon was saying there at Barks when we were first there, we used to fill up sea containers and send them out to Syria. And we were doing that. But actually, whilst it was helping those guys, it was costing the NHS an absolute arm and a leg. There you go. And actually what we found was that a team of people within NHS England started looking at reusing these things. And what we found was that the inspection process to give you a new crutch was exactly the same as a reusable one. So actually all the urban myth about you can't really use it all melted away. And there are a number of trusts up and down the country that are doing that very successfully. And then the other one, the last one I'll do, and then I'll stop, would be to look at furniture reuse. And so last year, the Environment Agency said anything that's been upholstered, if you're going to dispose of it, has to be incinerated because it has a persistent organic pollutant contained in it. Well, that's true. But if you have it reupholstered, and there are companies that will come to site and do that, and you can repair furniture. And we had a furniture repair scheme at Barts where actually it's being sent off and there are apprentices repairing the furniture. There's some social value you can attach to that, as well as I think in the first 18 months, we saved something like £200,000 in procurement costs because we were repairing something might cost, say, £30 to repair something that would cost £80 to buy new. And so, you know, a lot of this is not rocket science. I think, you know, one of the great things about working in the NHS and having professional people around, when you point things out to people, they get it and they go, well, we could do something about that, can't we? And away we go. We've got hoops to jump through to make sure that we don't make things worse. But actually, you know, there's plenty of us within the NHS. I don't know anybody in the NHS that thinks, oh, I'll get up today and I think I'll ruin the environment. It's not in our DNA.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like launching The Gloves Are Off 8 years ago, Helen, Amy and I feel like I've become the gloves woman and it haunts me a little bit. There you are bringing it up yet again. But I think the real challenge that I now take from it is that's one product and we need to be doing this at absolute scale and absolute pace. So yes, there's all of the challenges that I think Design for Life will help us sort, but we also need to make sure that our staff are trained in sustainable quality improvement, are able to lead these projects, and it's not reliant on just a sustainability team, but actually that we are all able and capable of doing that. Rhiannon.
I just wanted to jump in because you said about the furniture reuse. So we're not technically doing that yet. However, a project that has been started in the past year, it's something that was done a while ago and never really took off, and I've tried to relaunch it, is we use an online marketplace called Globechain. So it's more to do with bulky waste than furniture reuse. And it is very much in the early stages and sort of, I'd say, minimal at the moment. But when we do have bulky waste products that are sort of intact and can be used, or they can sort of take parts of or things like that, whereas up until the last year, they would just go to bulky waste and it was costing us an absolute fortune. So now when things have come down to the yard, and I'm really trying to get the word out about it because I'd prefer to know about it before it comes to the yard as well, we are identifying it, we're putting it onto Globechain, and charities and other organisations can contact and say, actually, I'd really like that, this is what I'd use it for, and they can come and collect it and then use it. That can then be expanded into furniture reuse. We have all the same sort of restrictions in space, but I've done what I can to try to the yard that we have for the bulky waste is a different yard. I've tried to sort of split it into two. So we've got a bulky waste section and a recycling section. And a lot of it is down to the time that I've had to be able to give to it, which is why it hasn't increased more. And I try to keep a track of what I believe it saves the trust. You can get the carbon data off of the website, but I don't understand it too much yet. But I believe in the last 3 months, we've saved about £3,000 from things going onto this system rather than for spending it as bulk, send it as bulky waste. But yeah, this is it. I'd say this is a project that needs a lot more work and a lot more people need to know about it a lot more. Then we can expand into bulky waste. And I also think having it internally would be good as well, because when people are saying that there's orders coming in, I mean, my office is right near where all the deliveries come into. So I don't just see what's going out, I see what's coming in. And the amount of bulky orders that you can see, there are desks, there are chairs, and then in the same day I'm getting rid of these same things as well. So I think we could do with an internal one for people to say, I don't need this desk anymore, I don't need this chair anymore, and other people to go, actually, that'd be great in my office, I could do with that here. So yeah, a lot of work needs to be done on it, but it's something that we're working on.
And at Barts, if you wanted a new chair or a desk or a filing cabinet, when you phone the procurement team, the number that rings is the head of waste, Neil Allen, and he because they store these sort of things and they have them in pockets around, and before they'll order something new, is they'll go through the list of what they've got, and that's where they've saved a significant chunk of money.
Wow, the opportunities here are absolutely endless, aren't they? We could have a number of Rhiannons and still have much more to do. Yeah, it feels like a little bit of an under-resourced area of the hospital, potentially, I would think. Now, I know that there's amazing organisations out there like the Ellen MacArthur Foundation that help us and industries understand about circular economy. Are there ways in which the healthcare sector could be involved? I think, Liam, you've already given us that example of the sharp spins, being reusable from plastic. Is there anything else you'd like to see us embrace from that cha from those types of changes?
I think it's the principle of what they're doing. And I, you know, again, we sort of undersell ourselves a little bit as the NHS. When we set out the HTM in 2023, we gave ourselves a target. So Rhiannon talked about 60-20-20, I'll call it 20-20-60, it just runs off my tongue a bit easier that way round. And the reason we did that was our target was to get our waste to net zero carbon. So when I was asked how to do this, I drew a Pareto curve, and Fiona, who's my boss, said, no, what we'll do, we'll cut the carbon from waste in half by 2026. And then we'll with that, so it's a bit steeper at the start and it's a bit shallower running into 2040. We are 8,000 tons away from that, doing that. So we've got a target of over 16,000 tons that we could go at in this year. And I already know that trusts up and down the country are actually on that case. So we have demonstrated that by segregating our waste better and concentrating and understanding those waste streams, we can cut our carbon down. And that's really powerful. Not only is it a pat on the back for everybody out there, so well done, fantastic work, everybody. What it's also doing is that I'm also communicating with the supply chains, both up and down. And I'm saying to them, we've got a target to do this. Look at what we've done. So we are going to continue on this journey, keep working away and chipping away at that. Just to add to that, by better segregating their waste and doing what we've been doing, we've also saved the NHS about £33 million in waste costs. So you know, we can look at Ellen MacArthur and we can look at all these other people. And I think the great thing about the Ellen MacArthur Foundation is when you look at what they're doing and you look at what it means, that's the sort of thing that should drive the behaviour changes that's required to go and do this. And we spoke about this earlier on, about clinical staff going, why are we doing this? Why are we using this product and not this one? You know, in the old days, we had something that did this. Could we not have it again? And I think that when we can crank that and we can get the 1.3, 1.4 million people that work for the NHS thinking like this, and I'm mad enough to think that we can, I think that's where we're going to actually do something very special. And I think, you know, the NHS being the first net zero healthcare provider on the planet, I mean, if that's not big enough goal to go after, I don't know what is. So, you know, and I think, you know, we can use these people. We can use DEFRA and other people to help guide us into the direction that we're going in, or maybe push industry into the various directions that we want them to be in as well. And I think, you know, there's enough projects going around in the NHS for us to look at that and actually polish those up into, you know, things as good as, for instance, the Gloves Off campaign was.
Yeah, that's lovely. Like I say, lovely doesn't even begin to describe those figures and those numbers and that projection that you're talking about. It's rare that you hear we're doing okay at something. And, you know, yes, there's room for improvement, but let's, you know, maybe see this as a positive journey that we're going on. So thank you for sharing that. Rhiannon, I want to just finish. I've taken up so much of your time, but it has been fascinating. By asking you, what would be the top things you would want us to look at?
I think what you've actually mentioned it to me over the last week, and it's opened my eyes about what happens. So I go into a lot of areas and I speak to a lot of clinicians, and the biggest sort of kickback that I receive is about compliance and sustainability versus practicality. And you must understand this from a clinician point of view. And obviously everybody knows the struggles in the NHS. Everybody is busier, everybody has more patients. In an area that last year had 20 nurses, now they've got 15. They've still got the same amount of work, if not more. So trying to convince people that they actually need to spend a little bit more time thinking about waste is quite difficult. And I always say to people as well that it both in this role and in my previous role, the hardest part of our job is convincing people whose job it is to save lives, and now specifically to save a child's life, to care about what they're doing with their waste is the hardest part of my job. But you mentioned earlier about the ecotoxicities and more about what happens if it's not segregated correctly. So really and truly, what I would like to sort of change is for people's perception to change, that it's not a case of do it my way or my legislation or my department. This is it. See the big picture in it. It's financial, it's sustainability, it's environmental, and see how that picture does feed into their role and is as important as their role. And it's not just sort of me coming in and whinging at them. It down the line, it will have as an important impact as what they are doing every day. And I'm not trying to undersell what they're doing every day, especially as they're getting busier and busier, which is only going to get worse from what we were told.
Yeah, it's a very tricky climate to live and work in right now, isn't it? Yes. But I think both of you have provided some hope there. And thank you so much for talking to me today. I feel inspired that we are heading in the right direction. Really, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Nicola.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Gosh Pods Goes Green. We would love to get your feedback on the podcast and any ideas you may have for future episodes. You can find a link to the feedback page in the episode description or email us at digital.learning@gosh.nhs.uk. If you want to find out more about the work of the Gosh Learning Academy, you can find us on social media, on Twitter, Instagram and LinkedIn. You can also visit our website at www.gosh.nhs.uk and search Learning Academy. We have lots of exciting new podcasts coming soon, so make sure you're subscribed wherever you get your podcasts. We hope you enjoy this episode and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.